Hey everyone, just a quick note about this episode. At the very end during the game, Mitch's audio got very distorted, so I decided to remove it. He wasn't saying anything important anyway, but don't tell him I said that. Hope you enjoy the show. Let us know what you think, and without further ado, alrighty, let's do this.
Welcome to the CubeCast podcast. Rich content by poor cubers.
So true, though.
It's so true. I'm Waffo, and joined with me is Brandon and a little Mitch. How are you guys?
Why am I little?
Because you're such an adorable bother, Mitch.
Okay.
Today is the 18th of March, 2016.
That's what it says on my screen.
Okay, great. It says in the corner of my screen as well. How's everyone doing?
I'm doing well. Yeah, doing okay. A little sniffly.
A little sniffly? Did you catch that from Mitch?
Nah, last time I was a bit sniffly too, but I edited it out pretty swiftly.
Oh, look at you and your massive editing skills.
Yeah, all I use is a movie maker editor for all the audio. It's great. Because I don't know how to use anything else, and I can't be bothered to learn. So
It's okay. So what do we have planned for the episode?
Well, today we have Jeremy Fleischman on the show. We'll be talking with him about the evolution of software in the WCA since he first started cubing, among some other things that we definitely have some comments about. But first, some housekeeping. I want to personally make an apology. Last time I brought up Sajwo from the Speedsolving forums as Michal Javuski, when in fact it is not him, it is instead Patrick Sevchik. My bad, I was not actually thinking. Using my brain was not something that was going on at the time. So, the correction, it's already been edited in the show notes, but I want to apologize to both of you. Next item on the list, Waffle, you want to talk about this one?
Sure. So we got, plans for merchandise coming along, isn't that right? So, we're going to keep you guys posted on our Facebook page about our merchandise, but we do have art in the works for them, so keep an eye out for that. But with all good things, everything is a work in progress. Isn't that right?
Yeah, everything that we're doing right now is a work in progress, from the website to all these new things that we're rolling out, like the Halfcast, if you listen to that. Thank you so much for listening to that. I listened to it, and I thought they did a great job for the first time. We're getting some music for them for their title sequence, as well as some other things as far as equipment's concerned. So, yeah, everything a work in progress. If you missed it, our new website is cubecast.fm. We have our software guy working harder than before about getting everything there. So everything should be there by the time this episode's out, as well as maybe our iTunes and RSS. And if you need to reach us for any reason, places to contact us. If you have questions for our guests, please email at support@cubecast.fm. For each of the hosts, our emails are Waffo, Mitch, and Ranja, all separately, at cubecast.fm. For the Halfcast, if you have any questions to submit to them, or feedback, or what have you, halfcast@cubecast.fm, and for website concerns, webmaster@cubecast.fm. All those are available on our website under the contact page, so you can find those there if you don't want to come back to this episode to listen to them. And without further ado, we can bring in our guest.
Hello!
So, today we have WCA delegate, the head of the WCA software team, primary compiler of T-Noodle, and a former North American record holder for One Hand Single, Jeremy Fleischman. How are you doing?
Great, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jeremy, talk to us, give us a bit of background about you that we didn't cover, some of your cubing history. So what it was like when you first started cubing, your achievements along the way, what you've seen through the years, because from what I understand, you've been competing since 2005?
Yeah, it's a long story. But yeah, I got into it my junior year of high school. I was visiting Chapman University for this math training camp thing on weekends, and I saw a guy cubing and was way too shy to talk to him about it, but I went home and read everything I could about cubing online and looked at Lars Petrus's method, couldn't figure out how to do it, and then I landed on Jasmine Lee's beginner's tutorial, which I was able to understand, and printed it out and basically memorized it without understanding anything.
All right. And what was your first competition, and what was it like?
Yeah, it was Caltech Spring 2005. this guy, Will Arnold, who didn't really have arms, set the world record for feet. So that was kind of my introduction to cubing. It was like a 9 or 8 minute solve. And yeah, I had a great time. I had no idea what I was doing. I hadn't learned F2L or anything, but I was just so excited to like have some human beings to talk to about cubing. Cause I was like, I knew there was this thing called F2L and I just like couldn't figure out how one was supposed to go about learning, memorizing 80 algorithms, which I think we'll talk about later, but,
okay.
Yeah. So talking to people about it was just like really awesome and gave me like so much more motivation. And, yeah, I just came back 1 year later for the next Caltech Spring competition and, tried to get people in my, since I didn't have people around me who were cubers, I was like, maybe I can create some out of my fellow friends in high school. And that kind of worked okay. One of them actually ended up getting faster than me, which was a way for me to learn. So yeah, that was kind of my introduction to cubing. But yeah, the full story goes on much longer.
Okay. Yeah. I was reading a bit into, reading a bit into your history, and you weren't on staff for Nationals 2009. That's where I first, I think, met you. But you were on staff for Nationals 2010?
I was on staff for 2009, actually. And 2008.
You were? Okay.
2008 was my first U.S. Nationals. I had an amazing time there. That was, like, the first time I got to meet all these cubers I knew online, but, like, had never met in person, like Dan Cohen and Ro Hessler, Tim Sun, and a bunch of other people. Mitchell Stern? Oh, man, I haven't seen him in forever. Brian Loftus, like all of these old cubers, many of whom are still around, which is awesome. And that just like got me even more jazzed about cubing. I've been on staff for every national since then.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's really funny because like those cubers you just mentioned, people only like we would know.
Yeah.
People who like started before 2010.
A lot of our listeners are not going to know the
They're
names.
Not going to know who all those people are. I mean, like Ro, maybe.
Totally Ro.
But even then, that's kind of pushing it.
Well, yeah, people should know who Ro is, but like Brian Loftus, I haven't heard that name in a long time. And I was a lot younger the last time I heard that name.
Brian Loftus was the one who convinced me that doing the Japanese flicking for OH actually made sense. Up until then, I was like, this thing is just too out of control. I can't do it. But then I saw him doing it in person, and I was like, okay, you're faster than me. It must work.
Yeah, that's a consistent problem with me and just like cubing. I'm sure this is a problem for both Waffle and me who don't take we don't take speed solving. I don't want to say that we don't take speed solving quite as seriously, but like our cubing styles are definitely antiquated. I don't do very many fancy finger tricks. I'm sure Mitch has all those things worked out already. It says here that you're a former North American record holder for one hand, and you were mentioning like the Japanese flick. What was it about one hand that was most interesting to you, and why did you stick with it?
Yeah, basically what happened was I got down to around 30 seconds before college, and I had a lot of trouble getting under 30, and I was eventually able to do it. But the part that really killed me was like trying to break the 20 second barrier. I just couldn't do it, and I was like getting super frustrated with cubing and might have stopped. I don't know. But what happened was Dan Zwan, who's currently my roommate here in San Francisco, I met him at a competition in San Diego like before I even went to Berkeley. And so he had like this group of cubers at UC Berkeley. Sorry, the fuller context we haven't explained. After high school, I went to Berkeley and got very involved in the cubing community there, basically like started the year that I joined. We made a club and started running competitions in 2006.
Still going.
to this day, the club is around and stronger than ever. It's amazing. But yeah, so I like what happened that really like kept me cubing and excited about cubing was like Dan started getting like world class at one hand. And then he set the world record for one hand, like the 17.9 second single at a San Francisco competition, and then also the world record average. And I was just like, this is awesome. I have a friend who is like the best in the world. I'm going to just learn everything he does and do it exactly like him. And so that got me like this other outlet to like, when I was like not improving at speed solve anymore, it was just like, I'll do a bunch of one hand because it's fun and I'm improving. And it also complements your speed solve. Like, you're turning slowly again and your look ahead gets better. So I really love one hand for that reason.
Yeah. What do you currently average for one hand?
I haven't aggressively practiced. I haven't, like, actually practiced one hand in a very long time. But it's just continued getting better because the cubes get better and, like, I kept practicing two-hand. I'd say that, like, if I did a solve right now, it would be 17, maybe. But that's, like, the middle of the bell curve. Anywhere from 14 to 18 is kind of something I'd expect.
For sure. All right. It also says here that you've competed on 4 continents. And I knew that you had been to a lot of places, but I didn't realize you'd been to as many countries as you had been to. What's it like to be considered one of the most well-traveled competitors in the world?
Oh, that's so funny. I don't think of myself as that at all. But I guess if you just go to all the worlds, you kind of rank them up. Like, yeah, you kind of just get to a lot of places. So, yeah, for me, it was just like, I don't know. I probably because, like, I started this club in high school and, like, I tried so hard to get other people excited about cubing. With, like, mixed degrees of success. And then, like, you know, I left and, like, that was the end of the club, basically. So I guess I've always had this, like, sort of, I don't know, paranoia that, like, this thing that I'm super excited about is, like, on the verge of dying. Which, like, looking at it from the perspective of now is, like, not at all true. But for whatever reason, like, in 2009, I think, like, Tyson was kind of starting to get less involved in cubing. And I was like, what's going to happen? This might be the last worlds. I don't know. I'm going to go no matter what. Like, it was during school, but I was like, I'll just miss some school. I don't care. And I convinced my roommate, David Gomes, to come with me. And so we went to Worlds 2009, and we both had a great time. I did horribly. I didn't even... That was a lot of fun. Everyone, when they saw me, would start speaking to me in German because my last name is Fleischmann. Oh. I have no idea what they were saying.
That's tough. That's tough.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're gonna move to some questions from our CubeCast team, and as well as from some listeners. So my questions for you specifically are: what makes a good cuber now, and how does that compare with other times in cubing?
Oh, like what makes a good cuber now versus what made a good cuber
then
back in the day?
Back in the day, yeah.
Oh wow. Well, if I knew what made a good cuber now, maybe I'd be a better cuber now. But yeah, I think that back in the day, it was certainly, like, a lot easier to just get really excited and, like, all of a sudden become world class just by, like, doing a ton of it. I mean, there was also, like, the hardware was huge. Like, that was actually, like, a real problem back in the day. It was, like, getting a cube that could turn well, especially for one hand. Like, when I was competing and, like, there was a... It was earlier you mentioned, like, I'm a former North American record holder for one hand, but that was, like, years after years after I wasn't good at one hand anymore. Like, there's this period of, like, a year or two when, like, Ro Hessler, myself, and Chris Zwan, Dan's younger brother, were all, like, kind of competing for best in the nation. And I was lucky enough to win U.S. Nationals in 2010. So that was, like, what I would consider the peak of my career. And I was doing all that on, like, a Rubik's brand cube. And then, like, the F's came out. I heard about the F's. So I didn't use a Rubik's Baron cube in 2010 because I heard about the F cube at Worlds 2009. So I guess that's when things started to, like, get a little better. But for, like, that period of, like, 2008, 2009, like, just using Rubik's Baron cubes was so painful. You'd go to, like, Toys R Us and, like, you could sneak into the boxes without, like, breaking them open and, like, try out the cubes because, like, they all were tensioned a little bit differently.
I remember that.
Which I learned about. Adam Zamora told me. He talked to, like, one of the guys at Winning Moves or Seven Towns or whatever it is. And the reason it was like that is because they had a machine that, like, had a lever that a human would pull to, like, down until it matched, a certain level. And then, like, that would embed the rivet into the cube. And, like, because it was a human pulling it, like, they'd pull, like, a little further or a little less far each time. So the cubes were always different. Then they finally got a machine that would, like, do the riveting and do it in the exact same tension every time. So Rubik's Baron cubes are, like, I mean, they're not good, but they're not as bad as they used to be anymore.
Oh, yeah, especially with the new design that they've implemented. And now they have tiles instead of stickers, so you don't have people peeling off the stickers anymore. And they overall turn a lot nicer. I actually have one here, and significantly better than my first cube, which was a 25th anniversary cube from 2005. So
yeah. I own two of these, yeah. Nice. Like, new tiled speed cubes, and I'm sorry, but I still prefer the Rubik's DIY kit.
What?
From, like, okay, forever
those things
ago.
Suck.
Okay, so, yeah, were those ever good? Because I think I remember hearing somebody say, like, a specific version from 1 year was good, and then none of the other ones were good. And this...
Dude, I
this
love
was, like,
mine.
From 2008 or something. I don't know.
Yeah. See, that's when I got my Rubik's DIY, was back in 2008. That was my first, what I consider to be one of my first speed cubes.
I don't know.
It was godly. I loved it.
Godly cube from 2008.
Yikes. Yeah, I got mine in 2000, freshman year, I think, 2006. And I just remember the caps would not stay in. They, like, wouldn't click in or anything.
Yeah, that's why you got some blue tack, man. That's how you did it. Come on. Where are you, nub? I thought you were a cuber for like an entire decade already. Jeez. What is this nub move you're doing?
All right, I'll go get a Rubik's DIY then. Now I know how to
Thank you. Thank you. You gotta go back in the past because they don't make the old design no more.
Yeah, speaking of old stuff, when was the last time you learned or updated your algorithms?
Oh, I love to this day talking to people at competitions and just seeing what they know. So I think the last time I did like a mind meld with someone was after U.S. Nationals this past summer. James LeChance invited me to come down to Florida with him, and Chris Olsen was hanging out for the week, and we just like spent a few hours probably every day just like, how do you do this algorithm? How do you do this F2L case? How do you do this OLL skip? How do you do this, like, PLL, like, finger tricks, algorithms, whatever? And, yeah, I think I taught him as much as he taught me. So, yeah, picked up some stuff. There's always, like, more stuff to learn for me. But going back to, yeah, what makes cubers different over time, it wasn't just the hardware. I feel like, or maybe the hardware influenced this, but I kind of think of it as maybe like, I'm inventing this as I go, so I might completely faceplant here, but I feel like there were kind of like three maybe big stages where, like, when I got into cubing, it was all about just like, go slow to go fast. Like, the only thing that matters is look ahead. And the slower you go and the smoother you go, like, the faster you'll be. And then, like, once cubes maybe got a little bit better or something, it was kind of like, the look ahead didn't matter. It was just like, so long as you turned fast and like didn't really suck at look ahead, you'd be like really, really good. And I certainly feel like today we've like, people have just like cubed for so long and like really good people who can turn incredibly fast and have like near perfect look ahead exist and can just turn insanely fast without pausing.
Yeah, it's amazing watching Felix's solves and about how much he paused when he first set a world record and how little he pauses now. It's just a flurry of moves for the entire 5-6 seconds, and then it's done. And I can't comprehend how that's possible. Waffle, did you have your questions?
Oh, I have questions. Yes, of course. Questions. So, I guess the biggest thing is, for me, is for someone who has been cubing as long as you have, what's it like just being part of the competitive cubing scene for more than a decade, basically?
I mean, it's been awesome to watch the community grow. I just think it's really, really cool. Just like how into it people are, how every year more people compete than the previous year. I just think it's really heartening to me. And I really love just like, how there is the WCA that it like unifies everything. And like, there's a lot of stuff that's like a mess, but it's just like so cool that there's one community. And like, that's just awesome. I have these friends that are like into Smash. A lot of cubers are also in, or there is a subset of cubers that are into Smash. And just like, whenever I look at the World Cube Association website and like see everything that's happened in any WCA competition, it's so cool that it's like all there, as opposed to like Smash, where it's like there's no like board in charge of stuff. There's no like rule set that, like, a committee agrees upon. It's just kind of like, we ran a competition, and, like, that's it. Like, the results don't go anywhere or anything like that. So.
Oh, wow. That's very different.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am not an element of that subset of cubers who are into Smash, and that's really interesting to me, because I don't know. I would think that there would be some statistics about how well certain people performed.
They, or like, all the top level... And again, I'm not that involved, and I'm probably going to say all sorts of horribly wrong things, but I get the sense that, like, the big tournaments are recorded, but not, like, all the little ones, and it's just not comprehensive in the way that the WCA is. But yeah, it's just been awesome to watch Cuban grow, and, like, I still have fun solving. I would not say... I think a lot of cubers, like, die out, especially, like, a lot of the people who started around the same time as me. And I think, like, the reason that that hasn't happened to me is that, like, I never had any illusions of being, like, world class. Like, there were points in time when I was, like, very good, I would say, by, like, humble brags, but, like, points in time at which I was, like, I could go to a competition expecting to win, like, a regional competition or something. Oh, yeah. But, like, I never was, like, in any illusion of, like, I'm going to set a world record or I have a chance of setting a world record. So I never, like, got that burnout that, like, so many people get. And you talked about this last week, Brandon, with regards to SKU.
Oh, yeah.
Just, like, when you're trying that hard, you just get so stressed. And Phil talked about this, too. Just, like, he had his one thing, and it was one hand. And when it didn't go well, it was just, like, I'm just so sad.
Yeah, it's like, you have nothing to fall back on. You're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's forced me to branch out a lot more, but the only person who was stressing me out that whole time was me, and I knew that there wasn't anything I could do to fix it in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I don't know, now that I've accepted that being world-class isn't all that there is to cubing, and that there's so much more, there's just unbelievably more, I can't think of why it wouldn't be worth it to just start cubing.
Absolutely.
And to get as excited about it as you can. Because that's why I'm still cubing. I think that's why a lot of people are still cubing. And then there's, you know, Mitch, who keeps practicing and keeps wanting to be good. But whether he'll get there or not, we'll see.
What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah. There's going to be a nice $100. $100 bet going on within the CubeCast. that Mitch is not gonna make finals. And
here's the deal. Here's the deal. So I got like 15th or 16th place in the first two rounds of 3x3 at U.S. Nationals 2015, and then I got 9.9 averages in all first three rounds, and then the final round is where everybody decides they want to do really well or do really horribly, and I'm like, ugh, because like. Everybody should have just done the exact same that they did, and I would have made finals. But no, I got like 30th place. So this year, let's see if I can like pull off sub-9 in the semifinals and make it.
But like, finals on the psych sheet is significantly like it's well under 9 seconds. Of course, people. I don't expect people to get PBs at this competition.
Yeah, add like 0.5 of a second onto that. Cause...
Yeah, but Mitch, I want to say this on the podcast. If you make finals at Nationals this year, I will give you $100 in cash.
Okay.
At Nationals. I'll have that ready to just hand to you.
Okay.
Speaking of Mitch, did you have some questions for Jeremy?
Yeah, so the last topic that we were kind of talking about was like how the WCA is a really good reference for cubing knowledge in terms of like competitions and that type of stuff. And how I know that Jeremy, you're currently working on some specific things for making the WCA even more all-encompassing. So when can we hope to see those changes? Like, I know that you've like kind of incorporated the logins, but I think you've told me some of the back behind the scenes type stuff that you want to do, but when is that going to happen?
Yeah.
For reals.
Yeah. So yeah, I joined the WCA software team, the board created the WCA software team almost a year ago now. The fuller context here is I had like just quit my job last year to work on some cubing stuff for fun, and the board heard about this somehow and asked me if I wanted to help out with the website because nobody was working on the website. And that wasn't something I was, like, all that excited about. But it was something that, like, really needed to be done. And that was made clear to me on several occasions that, like, if somebody didn't do something about the website, like, it was going to stop working in August of 2015 because it was using, like, a version of PHP that just, like, was going to stop being supported by our host. And so it was, like, there was, like, actually a ticking clock.
Oh, my God.
Which, then I thought about it, and I was, like, I thought about it some more, and I was, like, I could go work on, like, this cubing-related side project that, like, I'm really excited about, but, like, nobody's currently using. Or I could go work on, like, the website that, like, everybody uses every day. And it's, like, not sexy in, like, a technical sense. It's, like, a very, the idea is, at least, that it's a simple website. It's just, like, displays times. But it's, like, so important. And I just started, like, thinking about it more and getting, like, really excited. And it was, like, also very interesting to me the more I thought about it from, like, a technical perspective. Just, like, is this huge mess of a code base, which is not to say anything bad about the previous people who made the website. It's just, like, humans are terrible at writing software. And, like, especially the first time they try to do anything, like, it's just going to be a mess. And, like, nobody got paid. Nobody worked on this thing full time. It was just a mess. Nobody wanted to work on it. So I was, like, well, it'd be kind of interesting just, like, from a puzzle perspective to, like, figure out everything that's going on here and, like, try to make it suck less. And, yeah, so I, like, got started and I kind of just spent a month kind of just getting familiar with the code base, dealing with this, like, sunset coming in August where, like, the website was going to stop working. And, like, none of that hopefully changed anything from the perspective of, like, outside users. Like, it was a lot of, like, software work, but, like, nothing visibly changed, hopefully. And unfortunately, like, over the last year where I've, like, almost been working on this as a full-time job, it's just been, like, the board got super excited that, like, I was working on the website and, like, things were actually happening, that they started asking me for, like, all these back-end features that, like, previously just did not exist. Like, for delegates to create a competition on the website, like, previously they couldn't do that because, like, we didn't have an account system. So we didn't know who the delegates were and we couldn't, like, let delegates onto the website to create a competition. The delegates had to, like, email information to the board. The board would have to, like, copy paste stuff. It was, like, this super annoying thing. And, like, it was fine at first, like, in 2007 when the website came out, and it was fine until, like, 2013. But, like, the number of competitions per week just continues to go up. And, like, the WCA board was just spending a significant amount of time just, like, handling these, like, data entry emails. So, like, one thing I did, which was, like, a bit of work and happened around Brazil, like, during the World Championships last year, was just, like, to make it so that delegates could create a competition on the website. Like, a really simple thing. Like, not that exciting, not sexy, but it was, like, just something that needed to be done. And so it's been a lot of stuff like that. Most recently, Pedro on the board created a polling system, which I helped out a lot with, for delegates to be able to vote on things. Previously, it wasn't really, like, easy to get delegate consensus on anything. It was, like, we'd have these huge email threads, and, like, they'd be dominated by the people who, like, checked their email and responded to email quickly. But recently, we, like, held a vote. The WRC, Laura, the new leader of the WRC, created a few polls for us to just vote on a few questionable regulations. One in particular that I know Brandon just posted about on Facebook was the specific rules about what do you do when somebody is awarded an extra scramble, which even I as a delegate didn't actually know what the correct rule was.
Yeah, that was funny. I forget who I was talking to, and they were mentioning something about extra scrambles, and I took a look, and I was like, wait, extra scrambles are supposed to be done after all the regularly scheduled attempts are to be done. And that seemed like a very foreign concept to me, because, like, how competitions have been going around here,
yeah,
and I think in many places, is that people will encounter an issue with one of their attempts, and the decision will be made to give them an extra scramble, and then they get that extra scramble immediately, regardless of what attempt number it is. But the way it's supposed to be done is that the competitor, finishes their five allotted attempts and then goes ahead and does extra scrambles to replace the ones from their regularly scheduled attempts. And that was something that was completely new to me. And when I read that, I was like, oh, I think that this needs to be brought up. So I posted it in the Rubik's Cube Club at Berkeley. In fact, I posted it in that Facebook group. And I found your comment a little bit surprising. But then again, I didn't find it too surprising because that had not been enforced here at all. And through the last competition, I definitely know wasn't enforced because I judged some attempts that were extra scrambles. And they were done before the final attempts, before the fourth and fifth attempts of averages. But yeah, I guess we'll have to implement that at the next weekly competition. And then in Reno, which I think, three of us here are going to the Reno competition. You should go if you can, everybody who's listening. If you can't go, totally understand.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. Yeah,
there's
sure.
Hold up. There is 16 people signed up. Please sign up.
Why don't we just hold every event, Mitch?
No.
All right.
Extra rounds, okay, Mitch. But
I know that got into like a huge, massive tangent there, but what's the answer?
So we've done a few things that are user facing, but that basically what I was trying to say was to cover my ass and say that like a lot of time has gone into the website, but it's all been stuff that like unfortunately has been hidden from the community. It's just like administrative stuff. But what we're really trying to do is get like the results pages ported over to our new tech stack, which is Ruby on Rails. For anyone who's listening, the WSA software team is looking for new members, and anyone who's interested in Ruby on Rails or web stuff should definitely reach out to me. Okay, that shameless plug is over now.
That's a very useful plug, though.
That thought just popped into my mind. I'm very much trying to find people. Yeah, we're going to try to make the website more phone-friendly is kind of the next big thing that'll be coming, and like will actually affect people who use the website. Pedro actually has like a change from February that's like been going through review amongst the software team. We're very close. That's going to be the competitions list, the one that like when you go on the website and you click on like all competitions, you see a list of like
all the competitions.
You probably didn't know this. It's like the last 90 days and then all the future competitions is what that list is.
Can I ask this question very quickly?
Yeah.
Let me just pull it up really quick. Sorry. WCA home, maybe? Okay, so when you go to the competitions tab, and you go...
I'm following along right now.
All competitions. Why are some competitions light pink and the other ones dark pink?
Thank you. Nobody knows what this is, and a lot of people don't believe me. But some people... The people who know what it is, the reason you don't know is because you're not European. And none of the competitions you've been to use the WCA registration system. But competitions that use the WCA registration system, and I'm going to get this wrong. Okay, I just checked. It's the darker color means it uses the WCA website's registration system, and the lighter purple means they're doing registration on their own website.
Oh, okay.
It's terrible. It's going to go away with Pedro's changes. It'll just be like, the way it should work is, like, there should be a link directly to registration. And then it would be very obvious that, like, registration's on the WCA website. So.
Okay. Sorry about that, but that was just something
I... No, that's a great question.
I've never known that. Okay. Yeah, you can continue.
We've done some user-facing stuff. Like, if you've ever... I mean, this doesn't apply to any Americans listening, but a lot of European competitions use the WCA website for registration. And actually... The fuller plan, I don't think this is secret or anything, is to move registration for competitions in America from Cubing USA to the World Cube Association website later this year. So that'll be an exciting change. And so that uses the WCA account system, which has this whole, like, not anyone can claim to be Felix Zemdegs, for instance. You have to actually, like, claim your WCA ID and then, like, have it approved by a WCA delegate. So this allows people to actually prove they are who they say they are. Which also means that, like, people can't just upload random pictures for people anymore.
Yeah.
I've never done that. Yeah, I will definitely admit to have done that for Mitch.
You knew his birthday? Right.
Oh, yes. I always remember his birthday. It's 625 OMG plus 2.
Okay, I don't know if you just revealed his birthday to the whole world.
We revealed his birthday several times on the show, now that I think about it, so it's okay.
Okay. Well, anyways, birthday is not enough to change Mitch's profile picture anymore. Do you even have one, Mitch?
What? No, okay, you messaged me about that like an entire year ago, and I still haven't changed it.
Okay.
Oh, man. That's good. Oh.
Okay, and I'll just quickly ask this, but... you kind of already answered it, I guess, but the question that I asked Brandon about 30 minutes ago was, when will we wean off the nipple that is CubeComps and Cubing USA?
Well, yeah, Cubing USA is actively being worked on it just became a nonprofit, and we're working on getting the software off of there, like kind of just... turning all those websites into just static content, like all the old web pages will just become plain old HTML files, nothing exciting about them. So that information will never go away. And then really what I'm hoping to do in the next, like by the end of this year, is to have Cubing USA on the World Cube Association website. The big unknown is like how to do competition payment stuff. It's like, are we going to use PayPal? Does PayPal work in Europe and all the other countries that use the website? Is it only going to work in America? Is like prepayment only going to work in America at first? I don't know the answers to any of these questions. I've never done any form of like online e-commerce payment stuff before. And then CubeComps is a whole nother beast, and gets into the reason why I actually quit my job last year, which is I've got this pet project, which is meant to be like a CubeComps compatible sort of data entry competition manager thing. That's a reboot of live.cubing.net, which was a project that Jim Mertens and Lucas Guerin worked on many years ago. And unfortunately, the World Cube Association website has just been taking over all of my free time. But this cuber, Caleb up in Oregon, is interested in it and knows the technology we're using for live.cubing.net. And so he and I have been talking about it and working on it a bit, and we're actually I've got a flight booked up to go to Atomic Cubing 2016, which is like April, so like a month away, and we're gonna try out live.cubing.net there. We'll still use CubeComps, but the plan is to do data entry on live.cubing.net as well, and just see how things go. It's gonna be like a tiny 30-person competition.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I should go to Reno.
You should what?
Yeah, you're right. Reno would also be a good opportunity to try it out.
All right, so our last question from the CubeCast team is from Christian Pizza Segola, which is, do you think that T-Noodle needs improvement? And if so, what steps should be taken for that purpose?
Oh, boy. Yeah, so I was ragging on the WCA website for being a mess, from the source code being a mess earlier, and T-Noodle is also certainly a mess. That is like a lot of code that I wrote as I was learning to code, and it's kind of a mess. The direction ahead with it is like so hard for me to answer that question. Like, there's so many like science fiction kind of ideas that I would like love to have happen. Like, one thing I think is that like it should be possible to use the T-Noodle code on like both iOS and Android, because like a lot of people use iOS timers or Android timers, and like they should be practicing with the same scrambles they're going to get in competition. And same thing for websites. Like, whenever you use an online web timer, I feel the same way. It should be using the T-Noodle code in some way. And we have that with Android. I don't know if any of you use Daniel Chow's Plus Timer, but
I do, yeah.
Yeah, it uses the T-Noodle Java code base to generate scrambles and to draw them, which is really awesome. It makes his life easier as a developer, because it means, like, if the WCA decides to add a new puzzle, he doesn't need to go implement it himself. He just updates to the latest version of T-Noodle, and, like, life's great. His users are happy, he as a developer is happy. But the problem is just like, because the Tnoodle code base is written in Java, you can't run it on iOS. And that's like it. Which is a real bummer.
All right, so now we have some questions from our listeners. From Roy Lee, we have, how many states or provinces or countries have you been to for competitions?
Oh, I have no idea.
Oh, that's...
That is a good question. Is there an easy way to check?
We could probably use Daniel Shepard's
thing. I've seen his website. Don't remember where it is,
WCA
though.
WCA Profile Comparison. I just searched WCA Profile Comparison, and it's right here. Anyway, so, Jeremy, you have been to 94 competitions.
Yeah, getting
in
close.
5 countries and 4 continents.
All right. Sweet.
Dang.
If only states counted as countries.
So I guess that answered that question. And his second question was, do you swear?
Yes, a lot. If you ask Natan, he will vouch for it.
Okay. And then our next one is from Kim Jokinen. It's, have you ever really been far even as decided to use Even Go Want to Do Look More Like?
Ooh, I did not follow that at all.
I'll copy and paste this into the Skype chat.
Okay.
So you can even be more confused.
Have you ever really been far even go want to do more like... I'm going to go with yes.
All right. You heard it here, folks.
I just heard, like, in the background, you know, Kim going...
Yeah.
Just, like, disappointed your answer.
All right, and on that note, we're going to take a commercial break. After the break, we're going to be talking with Jeremy about some stuff, including U.S. Nationals 2016 and Euros and cool stuff. So stay tuned. This episode of the KubeCast podcast is brought to you by thecubicle.us, trusted by speedcubers and puzzlers worldwide. Go check them out at their website, thecubicle.us.
And we're back! So, that was a lovely commercial break. Thank you for that, Brandon.
You're welcome.
Voice is just so amazing.
I think so, too. No, I don't know. I don't have an opinion on my own voice. Anyway.
You sure about that? Are you sure about that?
I'm pretty sure about that.
Okay. Okay. Great. So now we have some news topics that we would actually want to just bring up real quick. The first of the topics is United States Nationals 2016's registration is now closed. Well, it's been closed, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been closed for the past 10 days.
I had no idea. That's what I get from staff. They don't tell me anything.
Yeah, so registration opened February 1st, and it closed on early in the morning on March 8th after reaching its competitor limit of 600 competitors. I messaged Kate Clement about the whole thing, and he said that the wait list is about 100 people long. So if you'd like to join the wait list, sure, all power to you. I just don't think it's particularly likely that you're going to be able to compete at the competition if you happen to go. This is pretty crazy news, because 600 competitors to sign up for a competition in, you know, 5 weeks, and for there to be this much demand, I think it raises a lot of concerns with the demand for competitions in particular places of the world and how we're going to keep up with it. It goes back to the Corey Sikowski question we had on the last season about how is the WCA going to keep up with the increase in popularity of cubing. Jeremy, what are your thoughts on this initially?
Yeah, this is all honestly brand new news to me. I didn't know about this. That's crazy. I knew that they were planning on putting a hard limit on it this time, unlike what happened with New Jersey, because there wasn't a limit, and then they were like, oh my gosh, we don't have that much space, and we can't host this many people, so we have to cut it off all of a sudden. But yeah, I mean, it's awesome that the community's growing, and you're totally right. There's this, like, what do we do about this? Like, is U.S. Nationals the kind of competition that you just can't let everyone who wants to compete at?
Well, yeah. I really like the idea of doing regionals. Do you agree on, let's say, having certain qualifications to attend United States Nationals just to make it seem more competitive. I think it's against the WCA spirit, in my opinion, though.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not too sure, because for the longest time, I think that, well, over time, I've developed the opinion that if somebody goes to a competition, it's their first time. As long as there isn't a competitor limit, they should be able to go and compete in 3x3 and get an average. This is something that I think, yeah, Jeremy, you've changed my opinion on that last part and get an average, because I was thought, yeah, you should be able to show up and compete as long as it's not full up. But if competitions are getting bigger and bigger, I can see in the very near future, U.S. Nationals specifically, getting to 1,000 competitors. Because we already know there's 100 people on the wait list. That's 700 competitors who want to show up, and there's not enough space for them at the end. Super-sized competitions. I would like for everybody to be happy with the way things go, I know that any decision that's made about qualifications for competitors to compete at a competition like U.S. Nationals is going to upset a lot of people.
Sure, it will. Yeah, it's a very tough question, and I don't have a fully formed opinion on this. Brandon, just like you, I used to always feel when I was running competitions at Berkeley, which I did when I was the president for like 2 or 3 years, and I was always of the opinion that like anyone who wants to show up should get to do an average. Like, because I went to my first competition and just had a great time. I didn't care how fast I was, and it like is what kept me cubing. And I want like everyone to have that first experience when they show up to a competition. But I guess like the more I think about it, like, does that first competition have to be U.S. Nationals?
Yeah, that's another thing. Well, that's a funny thing you mentioned that, because my first competition, the first competition I went to was U.S. Nationals 2009 at Stanford.
Yeah. Oh, really?
I heard about it very, very shortly before it actually happened, so I knew that I was not eligible to compete because registration was already closed. But I still went. I had a fantastic time. I met Ryan Zhu when I was there, but like Nathaniel Knopf when I was there, people with who I've had very long lasting friendships, and some people who I haven't actually met since. Like I met Stefan Pokman, I met Arnaud, I met some other people, and with having like the potential for competitors to want to show up to nationals as the first competition. Let's say it's in a spot where it hasn't been before, where people of that community can't really go. Because I know that there's some people registered for the Nevada competition that's going to come up real soon in Reno, whose only competitions were World Championships 2013 in Las Vegas and SkillCon last year, which was also in Las Vegas, because they're from Nevada.
Oh, really?
It's interesting to me to see that and to think that they might have another barrier to entry, which would be either they have to demonstrate their speed in some way, and it would. The only way that you could really do it is from previous competition results and using those Z regulations if you wanted to keep it as inclusive as possible in order to advance people to the next round. But yeah, interesting stuff. Any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, none for me. I'm just happy to be a staff member at Nats and, yeah, don't have to be the one making these kinds of impossible decisions.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. That will be nice in the future for, I think, the three of us hosts here. More on that.
Although for all you people on the waiting list, I can say there will possibly, I don't even know if staff count towards it, but there's going to be one spot opening up because I'm probably not going to be able to go to Nationals this summer, which I'm very sad about. But a very good, very old friend of mine scheduled his wedding on the same day.
Oh,
so I have to go to that.
Oh, there's my spot secured.
Yeah. Wait, you didn't sign up?
What?
Are you number one on the list?
Did you not sign up?
No, I didn't. Why would I sign up for a competition that's 5,000 miles away?
Oh my god.
You already did that. You already came to a bass competition. anyway. So yeah, U.S. Nationals 2016 is big, but we want it to be bigger. The wait list says that it wants to be bigger than it can be at this point. What do you think the ramifications are for venue selection in the future? Besides just bigger venues?
It's got to be a big venue. And we just, like, staff needs to continue to grow. And it's just so much goes into U.S. Nationals. And I think it's an awesome experience. And, like, the thing that I think is even more important than, like, letting everyone who wants to compete, compete, is, like, ensuring the very high level of quality for everyone who does compete. Because I think that everyone who does go to U.S. Nationals, I hope, has a good experience. I think there are times, like, where things are a little clunky. Like, even last summer, I just remember, like, FMC, like, starting in the morning, and then, like, people lining up outside of the venue just, like, waiting to get in because, like, there were only so many chairs and tables available, and, like, people wanted to have a place in the venue to just hang out during the day. And so they were, like, all running in to stake their claim in the morning as we were trying to finish up FMC. So, like, I feel like that's stuff where, like, we could improve upon if U.S. Nationals didn't grow again. But, like, even if we do improve on that and then U.S. Nationals grows another 10%, it's like, well, how do we make things better?
Yeah. That's scary. No other way to put that. That's just scary.
Yeah. What is your guys' opinion on, you know, because one of the complicated things, in my opinion, is the fact that U.S. Nationals is in a different place every year. And, like, we have to figure out all these things every year that, like, if we went to the same place every year, we wouldn't have to figure out again.
That's an interesting point that you brought up, because I was talking to Kit at one point, and he was saying, or it was on the podcast too, it was like, he was super close to booking the Riviera for the 2014 Nationals, I think it was, or 2015, I forget where it was, 2014, and not having it in New Jersey, and he was this close to making sure that went through, and they settled on New Jersey and did that, and then the Riviera got torn down, so that's kind of, you know, that's not possible at this point. But I wouldn't be opposed to having that in one place every year, just so that I knew what to expect. But actually being able to book the venue that same time every year, I don't know. I'm not an organizer. I'm not a big event planner, so I don't know if there are other barriers for that to actually happen. But I would be happy with that if it were a large enough venue that we could definitely grow into rather than immediately grow out of.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I don't know. I had done some actual research into trying to find a venue for a sizable competition in my local area. Because if it's in my backyard, I want it to be good experience for everyone. And in San Jose, where I'm at,
you didn't just mean literally backyard, you mean like...
Yeah, your backyard's tiny.
Okay, never mind. Sorry. Yeah, your backyard is really small.
My literal backyard is rather small. But in my area, in downtown San Jose and in Santa Clara, that's right close by, there are giant venues there. They're just ridiculously expensive. So the concerns for me is that if I were to look into these things, and if these were viable options, viable options for space, the only barrier for the organizers would be the price. Because if the price is off, then there's no chance. And knowing that competitions are only going to get bigger and bigger, will cubing just become more expensive over time? Will competitors have to take out their wallets and help pay for nationals more than they already have been? It's weird, because going through cubing growing up in competitions, I know that I would pull out my personal wallet and pay the $6 or whatever it was to compete in 3x3 and, like, blind if that happened, and I'd be fine, because I had under $10 to spend, and now Berkeley and Basque around here are charging a lot more for that, and there have been some funny jokes made about certain competitors who compete in everything who aren't Mitch. Just because...
Wait, what?
It's a joke. There have been some competitors who consistently, at every competition, register for everything and do very well at everything. But since they're not on staff, they're paying a lot of money in order to just compete every single time. I'm not sure if I like that. I'm not sure if that's going to have to continue in the future. Because I know for nationals, Mitch, what did you pay in order to compete at nationals?
Which one?
This coming year and this past year for reference.
This coming year, $0 because staff.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about that.
Last year it was like $100, and yeah.
Yeah.
That's not even that much. Like Riley Wu, who competed in every event, I think paid like $130. So
yeah. So if individual competitors are paying $130, and let's say the average price per competitor just continues to rise over time.
Yeah.
That might be necessary because of the venue constraints. Or the venue constraints that we're going to have. Like, we need a place that's going to need to hold at least, 3,000 people to just be sitting around. And it's just wild. It's just wild to me to think that it's getting as big as it is.
Yeah.
Because while everybody loves the fact that the community is growing, we have the concern that, the community is growing. And we got to cater to it. And I know that I talked about this last time, very recently, the Berkeley competition that happened a month ago or whatever it was did not suit the needs of the community, and I don't know what I can personally change in order to fix that for the Bay Area community. I know that's an issue in other places too.
Yeah.
All right. So that sums up my thoughts about the whole nationals thing. Any other notes on that?
I'd just say
for anyone.
I mean, competing in the San Francisco Marathon costs over $100, and from an organization perspective, like, one more runner at something like that event is just no effort at all. Whereas for like us at US Nationals, like the experience you get, the number of hours involved, and just like the amount of man hours that goes into like just letting people do their solves. You need like a scrambler, a runner, and a judge. Like, all that stuff is so much more involved than something like a marathon that can cost as much as US Nationals currently costs. So I guess what I'm saying is, while I don't like it, I can totally see it being completely reasonable to continue to raise the prices to be able to book these ginormous venues that you're talking about.
Absolutely. All right.
Okay.
We're going to move on to the new SpeedStax timer, because there's one that's coming out that has been posted on SpeedSolving. There are nice little pictures of it. It's got this nice curved bit to it. I think you had one of these at a competition recently, or in the past 6 months?
Yeah, before, I guess, it was technically announced, but it's not like it was ever a big secret. I was the person who was given, like, the Generation 3 timer way back in the day to just try it out, and I tried it out and found that it had all sorts of problems, and we told them about all these problems, and some of them got fixed, and some of them took longer to get fixed. But yeah, I got this Gen 4 timer, and it seemed rock solid. Like, I abused it a bit, and then I brought it to that Basque comp where Kit was, and mm-hmm. he abused it way more than me, and determined that it seems to be a pretty solid timer. Good. So I'm excited.
Oh, wow.
For
so this was an entire year ago then.
Oh no, this was at Please Be Quiet, I think.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that was in October. So, yeah, okay, well, that sounds good. There's also, because I know there was a scheduled release date for March that I heard about. I can't confirm that.
We have this WCA gear team, which probably nobody who is not a delegate knows about.
Nope.
There's a lot of knows. Probably nobody knows about. But I was on the gear team. I actually just got myself off of the gear team because I have too much stuff going on WCA related. But the last month I heard was May was when we would be able to start ordering.
Okay. There are also some homemade StackMat displays. I don't know if you saw this on the forums as well. There have been some.
Alex Moss just linked me to one. Somebody's designed something and is selling it for like $45.
Yes. Yeah, they're up for sale by Prototype Industries, which is the work of, it looks like, Caleb Gamble. I don't know if anybody else is working on that as well. But yeah, there are these. You have a functional display for Gen 2 and Gen 3 timers up to the 100th of a second, truncated. The LEDs are like 1 inch tall, and it's tripod mountable, and they're selling them for $45. So, much cheaper alternative, literally half the price of current competition displays. Of course, not nearly as big, but what are your thoughts on that? Just on that in general, because I know that you've done a lot of work with stack mats.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. I don't know how much profit they're making off of them. I think it's cool that people are trying to provide this service, and the WCA certainly wouldn't mind if, you know, organizers choose to buy these things instead and use them at competitions. So yeah, I'm all for it.
All right, awesome. Yeah, I was thinking of getting one for personal use, potentially, and the guy who was making them got back to me really, really quickly, and he said, "Oh yeah, what kind of thing would you like?" I just sent out a feeler email like a few hours ago about it because I saw that creep back towards the front page of the forums, and it looks really solid, and it looks very, very cheap to maintain as well. It just runs off a 9-volt battery.
Awesome.
But yeah, I don't know if I could use those for competitions. Mitch, what are your thoughts about that?
Cause, just homemade displays, you know, in general, or the specific one?
This specific one.
I don't know, I'm just going to be picky. And some design flaws is that it's small, and it's a tripod-mounted display, which means that you could either have two options of having the tripod on the table, which would be really annoying and large and would take up lots of table space, or you could have the tripods mounted on the tripods, like, on the ground in front, which wouldn't be too bad, but I don't know. How are they being powered?
They're powered.
It's a 9-volt battery or USB?
Ooh. USB. Okay.
That's very interesting, actually. Wow. Oh, yeah, I'm reading it now. Or if you prefer, you can plug it into the timer to your computer and use the USB port to power the display.
That could have some more functionality, because Jeremy's, your project, that could...
Another side project.
that could create another side project with the whole thing of live results.
Yeah. I just heard about this thing right before this call, but I don't know this guy at all. I would certainly love to talk to him about this, because one thing that, like, I really would love to do is, you know, take the times straight out of the timers and get them into a computer automatically at competitions. And unfortunately, just due to some technical stuff I'm not going to get into, you can't plug the timers directly into a phone's audio, like, input jack. You need to go through some piece of hardware to, like, modulate the signal. And it's possible that this device could potentially provide some sort of output that could then get plugged into a smartphone, and then the smartphone has internet access and is connected to some Wi-Fi network. It can do anything once it has the data. So... yeah, if this device could potentially do that for us, like, what I did was I made a little piece of hardware designed to just do that signal conversion. And I don't know anything about, like, mass producing stuff like that. But this guy certainly sounds like he knows what he's doing. So yeah, I should reach out to him.
Yeah, more about the going straight to digital data management instead of having a data entry person and all these scorecards. I know that you've worked on that stuff before, and you posted on your website like a whole comprehensive article with videos and images and all that stuff. Can you, like, briefly summarize that, and where is that headed now?
Yeah. So this is the project. It was like beginning of 2014. A coworker of mine saw me playing around with a stack mat and asked me about it, and we started talking about it, and he had a history in like electrical engineering before he switched over to software. And I told him about, like, I really wanted to take this timer and, like, get the data onto a smartphone, like, just by running a cable in, just like the square card readers that plug into, like, the microphone jacks of smartphones. Like, you swipe a credit card and some data gets into your smartphone. And I really wanted to do that with the stack mat, but I just, like, didn't really know what I was doing. I had done this before with laptops, like, plugging it straight into the line in jack on a laptop. And tons of people have also done that. And so, yeah, he helped me out, and we kind of spent like 6 months kind of offline. Some of this was during work, just kind of talking about it, designing, figuring out how to make this thing. And we designed this little piece of hardware that like took a little stack mat style battery, and you'd plug the stack mat into it, and then you'd plug the output of that into a smartphone, and you could actually read the stack mat signal. And it was going right into the audio jack of the smartphone. So like, because it wasn't USB, this meant you could also plug it into an iPhone, which I thought was really important. In retrospect, I've decided that's actually not so important, because at a competition, if you were going to try to automate data entry, the organizers are probably going to buy their own fleet of smartphones rather than using like the staff members' phones, because you're not going to want to like leave your phone at a table the entire day. That constraint of it being able to work on iOS and Android has, I think, kind of evaporated. But yeah, so anyways, I feel really bad about talking about this, because I've been talking about this since 2014, and it's like still vaporware, which is like, I've spent a ton of time working on it, and I actually quit my job last year specifically with the intention of going like 100% on this project. And then I like got sidetracked by the WCA website, and that's continued to like just take all my time. So yeah, the update is kind of like, as I've thought more about this stuff and going back to this comment I was making earlier about T-Noodle, like what's more important is focusing on like the stuff that's obvious wins. And like the more obvious win to me is like, we need to just like have a place to put the data in the first place. And I decided a while ago that KubeComps wasn't going to be the best place to do that, because it's like a closed source project that like I can't look at the code for and easily contribute to. So I decided we needed a KubeComps replacement, and that turned into a whole nother side project. And getting that working is like, you know, once you have this cool ability to like take the times from a timer and get them into a phone, it's like, oh great, now what do? Like, you don't have anywhere to put it. So getting that working, it's kind of like priority number one, and this is like not the science fiction thing. This is just like, let's make a version of KubeComps that like is open to doing more stuff. So I don't know. This is all like wishy-washy, and I still feel bad like talking so much about this vaporware, but it is something that's very important to me, and I plan to work on before I go back to like a more conventional job. So that's really the entire update, unfortunately.
All right. Okay, so that, I guess, covers that. And the next thing on the list, Waffle, you want to bring this one in?
What, Euros?
Yeah.
Euros 2016! registration is now open. There were some concerns that have been brought up in regards to Euros. I think the biggest one, in my opinion, is actually charging spectators to come in and watch. But it's not unheard of. People do it all the time at Liberty Science because it actually costs money to go into a museum, for example. Where are your opinions on this?
Well, it's €2 per day to spectate, or just as an entrance fee into the establishment. I think it's fine. I don't see it as a huge. I don't see that as a giant barrier to entry for people to attend competitions. But I understand there might be concerns for some people. I don't know why it would be there in addition to just I don't know if there's a reason for having it there except for that it would be used to just enter the venue for because that's what the venue wants. If the venue wants people to charge a general admission fee, then that's with the venue. Otherwise, no reason to have it. Unless you know, if there's concerns, like one of the notes here is that there, it could be an attempt at reducing overcrowding. I don't know. Do you guys think that this competition could be overcrowded easily?
Okay, if you're gonna charge €2 a day, that's like kind of a negligible cost, and the people that were already planning on going are still gonna pay that €2 or €2.
Yeah.
Well, it's not gonna do anything for overcrowding at all.
Yeah, because I don't know how people are going to. I know that all the registration is going to be prepaid, online, and all the organizers are individually accepting people's registrations once they receive their online payment or bank transfer or what have you. So I think that charging spectators per day, that would have to be done on site. Unless people, you know, at Liberty Science, when we had nationals there, everybody had a lanyard. All the competitors had a lanyard, rather. Yeah, if they had the lanyard, they could just walk in, and it was no question, because they had already paid for that. But I don't know. Some people were concerned about this because they weren't... I don't know if they weren't sure why it was there. But then it brings also the fact that the registration fee is significantly increased from 2 years ago when it was last held. Are these complaints... I don't want to say justified. Are these complaints, what is the source of these complaints? I know that last time I think it was mentioned off the air that registration was significantly lower. Like it was, I don't want to put a number on it, but it was a lot lower than it is now. The base fee is, from what I recall off the top of my head, €25 right now for registration, and then it includes free registration to 3x3. But for all these other events, I was looking at it, and it was going to be about €40 to €50 for me to compete if I wanted to go. And I knew that based on what I paid for U.S. Nationals this year, they're pretty comparable. So that's basically what I was expecting. Do you guys have any thoughts about these the price changes at Euros from being relatively cheap to significantly more expensive?
Ooh. That sounds delicious. Can he bring us back some?
Oh.
In comparison to what we pay for Nats, it's like, it's so much cheaper, even with I don't get it. I guess people just are not used to paying a lot of money.
All right, let's move on to the 2x2 Ghost Cube. Waffle, you want to bring this one up because you told this to me and you were very passionate about this subject.
I think Waffle went to Taco Bell.
Oh, s***. Oh, that sounds okay, so good. Oh, man, that was 20 minutes ago. Oh, man. Okay.
Let's just talk about the Ghost Cube real quick. Basically, what happened is one guy designed a 2x2 Ghost Cube, and now it is being mass-produced by which company?
I think it was Fengxi or Funds Puzzle. I forget what it was. It was when I was reading on Twisty Puzzles, all of the company name stuff had been redacted, so I'm not entirely sure.
That's a Twisty Puzzles only thing. They're not supposed to talk about the knockoff, air quote knockoff brands on that. They can only say this is a cube is being knocked off by a Chinese company. So that's why. But I think it was Funds Puzzle.
Okay.
What did I miss?
Oh, we just got started with the Ghost Cube stuff.
Oh, okay, cool. So it was Fengxi.
Oh, Fengxi.
Fengxi did, and it was like a side company, Lim Cube or something like that. Took Verist 2x2 Ghost Cube design, pretty blatantly, actually. And that was it. There was a whole huge controversy at Twisty about it. And Verist, the guy who actually created the cube, went out and urged people who sell the Fang Shi goes 2x2 to just kind of, you know, stop selling it while he resolves this issue with Fang Shi.
I like how we kind of said that, and then Waffo just comes in and says it again.
I mean,
you're welcome.
We didn't mention the part. We didn't mention the part about Verist urging sellers not to sell that particular cube until the matter was resolved.
Yeah, well, I think it was buyers too. Like,
yeah, kind of both. If you go and search cube shops and look for it, they should actually be not being sold other than some websites, which we won't mention, just for Verist respect out of that guy.
All right. I didn't know that copyright infringement of cubes these days was that big of an issue still.
Okay.
Like, I was under the impression that, like, all of that controversy had pretty much died down after V-Cubes. But
so
I guess I'm wrong.
Here's the thing. This situation was slightly different. There was no copyright on it at all. So it was just his design, and then is this what I was thinking?
So basically, like, there's stuff going around that says, oh yeah, no, the shapes on each face belongs to Verist. And they blatantly just took the faces, basically, is what they're arguing. There's a lot of things, like, you know, that are just surrounding the situation. I just really wanted to make it known. That's why I wanted to include it. Because it is newsworthy, you know. It's still an ongoing thing in our community, even though it's not as prevalent nowadays.
Yeah, this is the first case of design infringement that I've heard in a long time. Actually, interesting thing that you mentioned, Mitch, about there being no copyright. Last time I heard about that particular thing was with Albert Yu and the Mario CX3. For those of you who don't know, Albert Yu designed the prototype mechanism for the Mario CX3, and eventually had that... had some changes made to it that made it a little bit better. Of course, a lot of people are under the opinion that that's not that great of a cube by today's standards, or even the standards of its own day. But one of the things that happened initially was that there was some company that Albert had sent some files to. It's a classic case of, you know, me as an innovator, sending ideas off to somebody to get their opinion on it, to see for whatever reason, and them just taking it and then rolling with it because it has no copyrights on it, and mass producing it and profiting off of it immediately. So thanks for bringing that up, Waff, and because I had no idea before we started writing these show notes that was even an issue that was still here.
You got it, dude.
All right,
the last thing.
Next topic, I guess. Yeah, so the last thing we have on, or the second to last thing we have on here is that VLS, the subset VLS, was added to algdb.net. While that in itself isn't particularly noteworthy, I think what is noteworthy is that algdb.net now has almost 1,500 different cases for which it has algorithms. Like, there are 1,500 cube states that are on algdb that are all distinct that there are algorithms for. I feel like this is more testament to the algorithm learning culture rather than it is as a thing where, oh yeah, we just have these algs if anyone wants to learn them. It's more the thing of people are actually learning these algs and generating them with the intent of learning them and learning these hundreds and hundreds of algs in order to improve. What are you guys' thoughts on this algorithm learning culture that's developing?
It's always been there, I thought. Yeah.
Oh, you think it's always been there? Waffo? And Jeremy, because you've been here for longer than we have.
I mean, when I started cubing, people were talking about ZBLL.
What? When you first started cubing?
ZBLL predates my cubing knowledge. Like, my cubing career.
Oh, wow. Wow, I did not actually expect that.
Yeah, it like Zbigni, the ZB is like Zbigniew Brugham, yeah, right? Like Ron von Brugham, and then Zbigniew Zabrowski, yeah, or whatever. And yeah, I mean, people have always thought like, oh, what if I memorize like every last layer case? Oh, that's too many. But what if I orient all the edges first? Okay, maybe that's almost possible.
In that time, did anybody even have the inkling that they would actually do it and make it viable?
There was somebody in like 2009 or something, right? No, I think there was somebody even before Chris Tran. Or, like...
Yeah, the guy...
Well, I know that Chris Tran met
Morley Davidson.
Yeah. But he learned the optimals, the move optimals, for every single case, which is crazy to think about. I could not...
Also, anti-ZBLL and stuff.
Yeah, it's like, now AugDB has all these algorithms for ZBLL, full OLLCP, VLS, winner variation for either the front two slots, full EG for 2x2, all this crazy stuff. And it's making me think, like, I don't know, I think a big change for me is that what used to make people really good, going back to the what makes a good Cuper question, was that people would, in addition to, you know, going slow and looking ahead, would be that people would use that only and use their arsenal of their usually 78 AUGs plus the 40 however many that become AUGs from F2L for the CFOP method, and then just keep solving and keep solving and keep solving and keep practicing and improving, and they'd be fine. But now I feel like people are going well out of their way to learn hundreds more algorithms in order to get what I think is just a little bit faster. And now, I used to think it was just a little bit faster. Now I think it's making a significant difference in how people just approach cubing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the big thing that's changed. People's imaginations haven't changed. Like, mm-hmm, like we just said, I think people have been looking at ZBLL and just like learning more algorithms for a long time. Winter variation is also a very old idea, but yeah, now it's actually a thing that people like. I don't know if it's something they have to do, but it's certainly something that, like, a lot of top cubers are learning tons of subsets. Chris Olsen just posted a, like, 3-minute video that I think summed this up very succinctly, which was, like, he was talking about cubing myths and, like, learning algorithms, like, how many do I have to memorize to be fast? And he talked about exactly this idea of, like, well, someone like Felix knows a lot of tricks. Like, he doesn't just know CFOP, but he knows, like, a lot of ways to, like, see things through the last layer. Maybe not even, like, algorithms he's learned, but just, like, you know, the whole transition from OLL to PLL, just, like, being able to do that without a delay. And Mats Valk, like, VLS, exactly. Like, he's learned tons of those algorithms.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's super fast.
I haven't actually seen that video, but Chris Olsen, yeah.
Chris Olsen.
I'll link that in the show notes, and I'll encourage all of our listeners to watch that. Because I know that when I get off the call, I'll definitely be watching that. But, wow, I know that, like, cubers who started well after all of us are putting up videos on YouTube now. Like, Ty Marshall is one of them. He's actually a member of our PR team, and he's posting videos of him showing his ZBLL algorithms, and I'm thinking, what? I have not learned a single full subset of that. I've learned, like, a few ALGs here and there, but not quite to that degree. I'm sure Mitch knows some ZBLLs, but Jeremy, have you thought of doing any of that stuff? Have you, like, what's the extent of your algorithmic knowledge?
Not as impressive as many people's, but I haven't done much last layer stuff, but I've played around a lot with OLL skips, so I know a large subset of winter variation, and I don't know if you have heard of Magic Wandyful, which is...
Oh, I love it.
So that's another subset of VLS that my roommate David Gomes and I actually came up with when we were in college. And so, yeah, I learned most of those. I don't know all of them. And a few other random tricks, mm-hmm, here and there.
Speaking of really random ALG sets, I think I asked you this question like 3 years ago, but what is Jeff2L?
That is not an ALG set, but... That is just Jeff was a Berkeley cuber around same time I was at Berkeley, and that is when you are solving, you're doing yourself, like you're in F2L, and there are no pieces on the top layer that are useful. They're all last layer pieces.
Yeah.
But your F2L is not done yet. So just everything's stuck on the F2L.
So these are algs that will just solve pairs for you? Or?
No, not algs. It's just like, I got here. This is Jeff Duell. Because apparently that happened to him a lot.
So like, what do you do? Was there a solution to this problem?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just, you pause like hell, and then you proceed. So the great one was Dan Duell, which my roommate Dan Swan. What he would do, like, he had this problem where he'd always, like, not always, but sometimes would, like, while he was solving his F2L, he'd put pairs in the wrong spot. So he'd usually end up, he'd sometimes end up with, like, adjacent pairs swapped, like, this one needs to go in the other place. And so he actually, like, learned a couple of tricks for swapping them without, like, screwing things up.
Well, okay. I guess we're under the impression that everybody's still been talking about algs, but people are just learning them in a lot greater quantities than they had been in the past, and a lot of the really, really good people are doing that, and it's showing in their times.
Yeah.
All right. And the last thing here was, of course, the fewest moves world record that was broken by Linus Fresh, I'm going to call it Fresh, yeah, of Germany. If I'm wrong, I'm so sorry. This is a 24-move FMC mean. They're going to talk about more about it on the Halfcast in about, you know, a week and a half after this gets released. So the results were a 21, a 26, and a 25, or 21, 25, 26. I don't remember off the top of my head. Additionally, another competition that happened was FMC Europe that happened very close to that same time where Marcel Peters had won with two 25s and a 29, and there were like five 25s in the competition. There's a 23 by Robert Yao at the competition. So, Jeremy, you mentioned something about T-Noodle and these FMC results.
Yeah. So, with the 21-move solution, do you know about the controversy involved there?
I don't know about the controversy involved with it, but I saw the solution, and I thought it was a beautiful solution, but I didn't... What was wrong with it?
So the solution shares 11 turns from the scramble.
Oh.
Yeah, and I hope I'm not saying sorts of things I shouldn't be saying, but I mean, if the solution's up, the scrambles got posted.
It's definitely
with
up.
If you looked at the solution, I'm pretty sure, like, the first six moves were, like, the last six moves of the scramble, and then, like, the last five moves were the first five moves of the scramble. And then, like, the inside was where things changed up a little bit, because his solution was 21 moves and the scramble was 19 moves.
That is, yeah, I'm reading the solution now. That is accurate.
Okay, great. Sebastian Aru was the delegate at that competition, who was at the time the world record holder for FMC Mean, and they knew about this, and he had to decide what to do about this. So obviously he talked to Linus about this and invoked whatever regulation it is, which says, explain what you are doing here. And Linus gave an explanation. I honestly don't know the explanation. Brandon, you said you've looked at the solution.
I'm reading it right now. It says, start on inverse. The first five moves were the first five moves of the scramble, but those are just coincided. It was a 1x2x3 that was quite obvious of a beginning for him, he notes here, and the rest of the solution is just trial and error. So when he switched, the first few moves that he did, actually the first six moves that he did, were all the end of the scramble. They don't look directly copy and pasted. I don't want to say that, but the continuation, the moves are exactly the same as the last six moves of the scramble, but inverted. And then from there, his F2L minus one was three moves where one cancels, and he switches back to get a very quick finish to his F2L with a last layer skip. That seems a little fishy, but if he found it on his own, all that power to him, I guess.
And that was Sebastian's decision. It sounded legitimate. Sebastian knows the guy and trusts the guy, and we shouldn't, whenever possible, we shouldn't base our decisions as delegates based on how much we trust someone. It was like, it didn't seem like he was cheating. And I believe it. I believe that, like, he just kind of got, he saw something, and then like later on, after he submitted his result, they realized like, oh my gosh, like a lot of these turns came straight from the scramble. And then the question becomes like, well, why? And why, like, that had never happened before, fortunately, as far as I know. But then we talked about this, and like, I don't know if you guys know how T-Noodle generates scrambles.
No clue.
Should I talk about that real quick?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's the Kosciuszko algorithm, which is like a two-phase solution, which basically does what some FMCers do, which is like, they do ZZ. They like try to orient all their edges, and then they solve the cube using like RUL and, you know, F2B2 and U's and D's or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what T-Noodle does, is it picks a random state. It then applies the Kosciuszko two-phase algorithm to find a solution to that state, which means like trying to orient all the edges and then solving the cube while keeping all the edges oriented. So if you ever, and then what it does, it concatenates those two, or it appends those two things to get the solution. And then it inverts that and then spits that out and says, here's your scramble. This will get you to that state. So if you ever look at like a bunch of T-Noodle scrambles, you'll see the first like 5 to 10 moves have a lot of half turns. They're like R2, L2. You're never going to see like an R and an R prime in there. Yeah. And that's because of the nature of the algorithm we're using to generate scrambles, which has this unfortunate side effect of being a way that some people approach FMC is they want to orient all their edges at the beginning. And the T-Noodle scrambles, if you wanted to be malicious about this, you could theoretically use the scramble that you're given at competition to like find some useful moves that'll orient some edges. So anyways, the software side of this is like, what can we do to, like, assuming that people like aren't trying to be malicious, but they're just like honestly looking for good things, and like the good things they happen to find happen to be the same as the good things that the computer happens to find. Like, what can we do to make the computer dumber and like have the computer find less good things? So the solution we settled on, and like literally I'm going to work on possibly after this call, is our FMC solutions, our FMC scrambles are going to start and end with the same three turns, like always. And then the inside will be a random state scramble. And this should avoid that problem, because now there's like these useless moves at the start and the end, and they're always going to be the same.
Huh. All right.
Is this going to be applied to only FMC, or is this going to be applied to...
Yeah, this will only apply to FMC.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, that's... Wow, that's... Because there aren't any better solution algorithms that exist that people currently don't use for FMC. Is that right?
You mean like computer algorithms?
Computer algorithms, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can... There's like the thistle waffle. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, Thistlethwaite. Yeah,
and that's like 50 moves or so. Yeah, I mean, I'm not one of the people that comes up with these sorts of things. This is like very much not my area of expertise with software. But yeah. One thing that like in the few decades of like software work that has gone into like theoretical cube solving is like they've worked really hard to come up with good ways of solving it. They haven't worked very hard to come up with like meh ways of having a computer solve a Rubik's Cube.
That's totally the point of creating a near optimal solver, creating a this is all right sort of solver. Yeah. That's good. But yeah, well, now that I've seen that, I'll post that link in the show notes as well. Anyway, so that finishes our regular news, and now we're going to move on to a game called Gotta Go Fast. Waffle, you want to describe this one?
All right, Gotta Go Fast. So basically is a quick-fire-style trivia game about Felix Zemdegs, our precious cinnamon roll, and us, basically. So what it is we're going to go ahead and pretty much ask questions related to our results against Felix, basically. So it's going to be fun. There's two sets of questions, one's by Brandon and one's for me. So Brandon can do his thing, and then myself, Jeremy, and Mitch can answer which is the correct answer. So tally up your own goddamn points, by the way.
I will be sure to
pencil and paper.
I'm going to be typing them out here. So, which is faster, Felix's Skube average or his own best 3x3 single? What do you guys think? Okay. You got your answer. All right.
Wait. Oh, we write it down is the idea.
Yeah. So. Oh no. The idea is to say what it is. I didn't flush the idea of actually saying what it was, like saying your answers out. So let's figure this out. On three, we're all going to say what our answer is. So 1, 2, 3.
3x3.
3x3 single.
Okay, so Jeremy said Skube, the other of you two said 3x3, and it is in fact 3x3. Felix has a 5.39 single for 3x3 and a 5.63 average for Skube.
I think I knew that one. Okay.
All right, so the next one. Which is faster, Jeremy's best 4x4 single or Felix's best blind single?
Oh, man.
All right, I'll give you 5 seconds.
Oh, wow.
All right.
I have no idea.
1, 2, 3.
Jeremy's best
4x4 single. Everybody said Jeremy?
I did.
Oh, yeah, okay. It is, in fact, Felix's best blind single.
God damn it.
Jeremy, your best 4x4 single is 42.80, and Felix's best blind single is 40.28. I actually... It slipped my mind that Felix was better at blind than I expected. So, next one. Which is faster? Felix's best 5x5 average. Jeremy's best 5x5 average, or Felix's best 6x6 mean.
Oh, I think I know this one.
I don't want to just rag on Jeremy here, so I have some questions that aren't about Jeremy. All right. 1, 2, 3.
Felix.
Me.
Jeremy said himself, and the other two of you said Felix, and it is indeed Felix.
No!
Sorry, Jeremy, your 5x5 average is 1.
I'm 0 for 3 right now.
Your average right now is 1 minute 49.78, and Felix's 6x6 mean is 1 minute 43.83, which I believe is the current
record. Oh my gosh.
Two more from me. Oh no, three more from me. Which is faster, Felix's first 3x3 single world record, or my only magic average ever? I'll give you a second to decide.
6.77 or... Okay.
Yeah. All right. 1, 2, 3.
Brandon. Magic.
Felix.
Oh, wait. What did you say, Jeremy?
I said Felix.
Felix. It is, in fact, me. I have a 6.65 magic average. I am very proud of it. Felix, however, did get a 6.65 3x3 single after the 677, but... Nobody really worries about that anymore. all right, so which is faster? Waffo's best Mega Minx average or Felix's former 4x4 blindfolded world record?
Oh my god.
I remember the 4x4 blind.
But do you remember the time? All right, one.
No, I thought it was like 4 minutes something.
Okay, are you ready? 1, 2, 3.
Waffo.
Felix.
All right, Waffo said Waffo, and Jeremy said Felix, and Jeremy wins this one. It is, in fact, Felix. It's full blind. Full
yes! Finally!
Waffo's best Megaminx
average. 1 out of 5.
Well, okay, Waffo's best Megaminx average, 3 minutes, 43.92. And then Felix's former four blind was 3 minutes, 37.8. And last one for me.
I was right for the wrong reasons.
All right. So, last one. Which is greater? The total number of competitions that Jeremy, the hosts, and Felix have been to, or the number of continental and world records Felix has set in his career? 1, 2, 3.
Competitions.
Unfortunately, for everybody, Felix Zembegs has set 228 continental and world records in his career. The total number of competitions that each of us have been to, with duplicates included, and counting the ones that Felix has been to, is 226. Very, very close, and unfortunately, none of you got that point. So, Waffle, you want to move to your 6 questions?
And we'll just add up mine and yours together?
I'm keeping I'll keep track.
Okay, cool. All right, so I guess the next set of questions. All right, so again, 5 seconds after I ask, which is faster, my current 3x3 single or Felix's first official SKUB average? All right, 3, 2, 1.
Waffo.
Felix.
It is actually Felix's first official SKUB. I have an 8.86 official, and Felix's first official SKUB average was 8.78.
Ooh.
So.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. The next one. Who was faster? Brandon's square one single at the first round of Basque 8, or Felix's square one single in the first round of Worlds 2015?
I don't know how good he is at square one, so.
3, 2, 1. Yes.
Brandon.
Oh.
It is actually Brandon.
What?
Brandon had a 21.83 and Felix only had a 25.16. So that implies that he needs to step his game up.
Yeah.
All right. okay. Next up, who had the better average? Or which is the better average, rather? Mitch's first Master Magic average or Felix's last Master Magic average? Bringing it back.
Oh, man.
All right. 3, 2, 1.
Felix.
It's actually Felix who had the better one. Mitch, your first Master Magic average was 688, and Felix's last was 674.
Oh, man.
Close, but unfortunately no cigar. Next up is, which is the better single? J-Fly's best 3x3 solve in all of United States Nationals 2014? Or Faz's best 3x3 solve in all of Melbourne Open Summer 2010?
No, that was the second competition. His first one was in 2009.
3, 2, 1.
Felix.
You're all wrong.
What? Go Jeremy.
J-Fly's best solve in Nats 2014 was 8.22, and Felix's best was 8.33.
Oh, man.
Yes.
I'm happy to be wrong about that.
So congratulations to J-Fly for that one. For beating Felix in that question specifically. So the next one is, which is better, Felix's current 5x5 average or my current 4x4 average?
I know. Ooh. This one. I know this one. This is no problem.
3, 2, 1.
Uh-oh. Felix.
It's actually God. Felix. Felix has a better 5x5 average, and I have a 4x4 average. He has a 50.15, and I have 54.83 for 4x4. So I'm trash.
You were in the 40s. Oh, anyway.
At home, maybe. You know?
Dang.
And my last one is, which is better? Mitch's current 2x2 single, or Felix's best magic single?
2x2 single.
Who cares about magic single either?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1.
Mitch.
Yeah, Mitch.
Mitch has it. He has a 1.16 2x2 single, and Felix's best magic single was 1.3.
Okay, so one thing that I did not think about, that was the last question, by the way. One thing I did not think about is the fact that Waffo and I were going to be not answering half the questions. Should I just double the amount of points that we got, Waffo?
No. What we're going to do is add up our points.
Add up our points together? So we are one collective
Yeah,
unit?
So we're one team. Team.
Lost anyway.
How much did you get?
Yeah, so Waffo got 3, and I got 2, for a total of 5 for us. Jeremy got 6, and Mitch got 7. So Mitch wins. Congratulations to
Dang.
Mitch.
Dang.
And in that case...
There were 4 questions involving me and Felix, I think, and I got every one of them wrong.
Yeah, you
the
did.
First three,
I think.
I voted for me, and then the one that was me.
I like the square one, because like I totally thought, you know, Felix is probably better than me at square one, just universally, and I'm halfway glad I was wrong, but not for that point. I wish I could have gotten that point and been tied with Jeremy now, I guess.
yeah, no, never.
Well, so, thank you for that second set, Jules, because I was doing miserably.
Yeah, you're welcome. So you want to do some Skype Team Blind or no?
I'd love to.
All right, so second game, Skype Team Blind. Lucky I already have QQ Timer up and running for that.
Okay, I need to turn on the lights. It has gotten dark here.
It has also gotten dark here. So, Jeremy, you'll be calling, and there's a scramble. I'm going to add this into the show notes, because this is not currently in the show notes.
Okay, I'm back.
All right. So, for all listeners at home, I'm going to read out the scramble. It is F2, U2, back prime, R2, down 2, F, L2, R2, down 2, U2, F2, R prime, U prime, L, U2, L2, U prime, F, L prime, F, down. Alright, let me do that on mine. And your cube should look like, give me just a second, it should look like this.
Who's calling? Me?
Jeremy, you are calling.
Okay. Are we timing it?
Yes. Start with. Tell us your starting orientation, and I'll put on the blindfold.
Okay. Who's doing the timing? Should that be me?
I think I'll start the timing when I do my first move.
Oh, okay. Great. Okay. Well, I'm holding it WCA style, so green front, white up.
Okay.
And do we do some inspection, or do we just go for it?
Whatever you want to do. Whatever suits your heart.
Okay. Well, let's start by turning the cube upside down, and the way we can do that is Z2.
Z2. All right.
Ready to rock.
After you.
Okay, ready, set, go. So there's the Z2. Let's do anti-slice, L prime, R prime.
What is anti-slice?
L prime, R prime.
L prime, R prime, okay.
F, D prime, L, U prime, R2, D, R prime, U prime, R, U prime, L prime, U prime, L, U prime, L prime, U, L, 2, U, 2, L prime, U prime, L, U, 2, L prime, U, R, U prime, R, 2, U, R, 2, U, R prime, U, 2, R, U, R prime, U prime, R, U, R prime. Okay, U, 2, left-handed, double thick, Tsune.
That's starts with a wide L prime.
Correct. Okay. And now we have a G perm starting with F prime, U prime, F.
where are the headlights and where is the pair?
I can call out the turns, but the headlights are on the B face.
Okay.
The pair is in the front. It's pointing left right, but it's like on the right hand side.
Okay, so the pair is FU and FUR?
Yes.
That's the one I don't know. Awesome.
Ah.
Alright, that was 127.09. I was off by a U prime AUF, so I'll plus two that. So 129.09 for me.
I have a cross.
Okay. You have a
cross. Oh, okay. Shoot. Well, that was miserable.
I mean, it happened. It happened for one of us.
Okay, so I was not totally off.
According to my cube, no. You were one.
Okay.
It was just the AUF at the very end. So, good job. All right. Thank you so much for being on the cast. We've been talking for a long, long time, like 3 hours now.
Yeah. Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get this finished and uploaded quickly. And thanks so much for being on and for giving us so many insights about stuff that we had no idea about. All right, so you're welcome. Gonna move to the final words. Oh, Waffle, you want to do your final words?
Oh yeah. By the way, these are phrases that we would say before we die.
Morbid.
and my final words is the milk's a little chunky, don't you think?
Mine is. Hey, you guys want to see a dead body?
All right, so that concludes this episode, man.
Yeah, if you want to get in touch with us, we gave our emails earlier, but just again, our website is qcast.fm. On the support page, sorry, not the support page, on the contact page on there, you'll see all the host emails. It's either Waffo, Mitch, or Ranja at cubecast.fm. For our support team, for questions for our future guests, which will be announced on the next Halfcast episode, support at cubecast.fm. For all your web concerns, please contact webmaster at cubecast.fm. And for the Halfcast, if you have any questions for them, things you want to hear about, that is Halfcast at cubecast.fm. And until next time.
Bye. Thanks for listening.
Woohoo!
Bye. And